We do have an informational an informational hearing scheduled, and I think we will do that first, as it is scheduled. So if you could come up, please, Dr. Goldberg and Ms. Erin Kelly Seal. I want to apologize for being late. I was on my way down here at 3 o'clock, and I heard my name mentioned in another committee that I had been waiting to testify for, and in judicial committee. So I went to that committee and was able to testify. I don't know if I did any good or not, but I was there.
Sure you did.
Yeah. So I'm interested in hearing the update on the governor's Oregon Pioneer Prescription Drug Project. So who wants to go first?
I'll start. I'm going to turn it over to Erin, and I have with me our Pioneer. Oregon Pioneer.
Very good.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, the administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, here to give you a brief update on the Pioneer Prescription Drug Program, which is our plan to look for a way that we can legally and safely import drugs from Canada to get prescription drug price relief for those people who need it the most. I think, as you're aware, there has been there are currently a lot of efforts to import drugs. We actually have a system currently whereby people get on the internet anywhere, any place, and can get prescriptions from Canada. That's in a way that is not in any safe or regulated way. And what we're looking to do is to be able to create a system whereby we can, number one, get prescription drug price relief on those drugs where we can get prescription drug price relief for people who need it the most, the uninsured. Number two, do that in a legal way. And number three, do it in a way that involves our local doctors and pharmacists so that we're not going out of the country and having others not involved in someone's day-to-day care take care of that. We have put together a proposal which is currently under consideration at the Federal Drug Administration as part of the Medicare Modernization Act, the Medicare Drug Act. It allowed states to apply for waivers to do exactly this, and we have put together a plan that would allow the Board of Pharmacy, and this has been in conjunction with the Board of Pharmacy, it allows the Board of Pharmacy to designate a list of appropriate FDA-approved drugs and for them to license Canadian wholesalers in the same way that they currently, our Board of Pharmacy currently licenses U.S. wholesalers. They license and certify wholesalers in this state. The Board of Pharmacy would do the same thing for a Canadian wholesaler. Then that local pharmacist would be allowed to import drugs from that licensed and regulated Canadian wholesaler, and local pharmacists would then be allowed to provide a low-cost supply to individuals without health insurance coverage. This is a totally voluntary system and creates a closed system, the type of system that I believe everybody's looking for. Several months ago, the president had convened a task force by the Surgeon General to look at this issue. They issued a report, and in that report, very strongly talk about maintaining a closed and regulated system to assure safety and integrity. And we believe that that's what we've done. We've created the same system that currently exists and allows pharmacists to voluntarily import drugs from Canada. On a last note, the list of drugs would be very small. Mm-hmm. And one of, I believe, the misconceptions is that all drugs in Canada are cheaper, and that's not true. The vast majority of generic drugs are more expensive in Canada than they are here. And we don't want to set up a system that would allow for importation of something that wouldn't allow an individual, an uninsured individual, prescription drug price relief. So the list would be very small. We anticipate 40, 50, 60 drugs that would be brand name drugs for which there is no generic, no cheaper alternative here in the U.S. Once again, there are many categories of drugs where there are safe and effective low-cost alternatives that already exist. There's no reason to set up a system to bring in a discounted higher-cost drug when an available low-cost alternative already exists in the U.S. So in a nutshell, that's the proposal that we've put before Secretary Leavitt. And let me turn things over to Aaron.
Quick question. What about the evidence-based findings that OHSU has published on certain kinds of drugs that may be still available in Canada but not recommended? Would we pay attention to the recommendations of evidence-based findings on the kinds of drugs we might import?
Chair Morissette, two issues. One, we would only be looking to import FDA-approved drugs. Secondly, we would be using the evidence-based research, which would help develop the list of appropriate drugs to import. There would be no reason to import a drug for which there was an effective, low-cost alternative that already was available here in the U.S. No reason to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the Governor's Health and Human Services Policy Advisor, and I just wanted to just sort of walk through briefly. Bruce has gone through the substance of the proposal, but the Governor actually had an opportunity about 2 weeks ago to speak personally with Secretary Leavitt, with the Federal Health and Human Services Administration, to talk about the proposal, and I wanted to just give you an update on that. The timeline, briefly, is that we submitted this application last August, and at that time, there was a different secretary at HHS at the federal level, Tommy Thompson, so we submitted our proposal to him. We had a few challenges in at first at getting a response from them, but once we were able to hear back from them, they asked us to consider ourselves on hold pending the report that was going to be issued by the Surgeon General that Bruce referenced. That report was issued in December of last year, and almost around that same time, Secretary Thompson resigned and the Bush administration appointed now Secretary Leavitt for confirmation. He was confirmed at the end of January. So there were some intervening events following our application that I think led to some of the delay that we've experienced in getting that application considered, but we're very encouraged now that the governor was able to have this one-on-one conversation with Secretary Leavitt about the application. And basically our message to the secretary was that the Oregon project is by its very nature a small single state pilot project that would allow and really be an ideal way for the administration to evaluate the legal importation of Canadian pharmaceuticals within a regulated system. As Bruce mentioned, we combed the findings once the task force report was released last fall to discern whether or not we needed to make changes to our application based on what the task force had found. And we concluded, actually, that the task force report arguably supports Oregon's application because it really emphasizes a couple of key things. One, it emphasizes the fact that importation is already happening in an unsafe and unregulated manner, and that in order to make importation safe, there would need to be a closed regulatory system designed, which is exactly what is included in the Oregon proposal. It also emphasizes the need for drugs, as you point out, Chair Morissette, to meet current federal standards, and the Oregon proposal would only allow for importation of approved drugs, FDA-approved drugs. And it also the report also stressed the need to be able to demonstrate savings, which is also a legal requirement. We think we've done that, and I submitted a copy for you of what we have submitted to the federal government of the application that goes into some detail of what the program looks like, and also attached to it is a cost sheet that shows some price comparisons between average prices here in the United States at the time we put the application together and an average price in Canada. So we are committed and believe that because of the limit limited number of drugs that would be available under the program that we can demonstrate that this program would only be implemented where savings can be achieved by the ultimate consumer. Another safeguard within what we're proposing to do is the board would be working with pharmacists to establish a fixed dispensing fee to make sure that savings are passed on to consumers. So again, we stressed with Secretary Leavitt our belief that this application really affords the administration an opportunity to test some of this, to test the theory actually that is supported through the task force report that was issued last December. And the only other thing I would say, and then open it up to questions for you, in terms of timeline, we have just this week been informed the FDA is working on the application. We've been asking them, if possible, to have a timeline in place so we can keep you apprised in our efforts to get them to articulate one. They haven't been willing to do that yet, but we're hopeful. And the Secretary, as a former governor, was willing to acknowledge our need to have some response one way or another on this proposal since it had been pending for so long, so that was very encouraging to us. The only thing I'd point out is that even just today, there was a report that former FDA Commissioner David Kessler testified at the federal level in support of some legislation that's pending there to allow for legal importation. And the message that he gave was really strong, and I thought very supportive also of where we're trying to go. He said, we already have a system of importation of drugs that jeopardizes the public health. And that's exactly what we're trying to avoid through our proposal, is to create a safe and legal means by which we can protect the public's health and allow people to have access to more affordable medications.
Thank you. As I understand the proposal, it would the reimportation would be from a warehouse in Canada to a warehouse in Oregon. Is that correct? It would be.
Jim Moore said it would be from a wholesaler in Canada to the local pharmacist, in the same way that a local pharmacist currently buys from a wholesaler in Oregon. It would be the parallel relationship.
Okay, I guess I would ask another question then. A wholesaler, for instance, in Springfield, we have a McKesson Robin wholesaler. I was under the impression that, for instance, drugs would come from the McKesson Robin wholesale house in Canada to the one in Springfield, and from there would be a distribution. But what you're saying is that the pharmacies who choose to participate, because they would have another class of drugs they would have to segregate, because it would be a reimported
yes.
product at a different price, so they would have to have that separate. But they would order directly then from a Canadian warehouse, is that what you're saying? And not have to go through a local warehouse?
Jim Moore said the system that would be set up would be as per the Board of Pharmacy's current protocols. Whether the Board of Pharmacy would have it go from wholesaler X to wholesaler Y, that's a detail that's actually left to the Board of Pharmacy to set up the same type of system that currently exists within the state, and for them to assure the closed system and the safe transfer.
Chair Moore said, I would only add that we actually went on a visit to the McKesson facility that's close by here in Wilsonville, and they actually did share with us that they have their company has also wholesale distribution facilities in Canada, and so that may be one example wherein it would be very easy for that particular company to do that shared kind of wholesaler relationship where the pharmacist locally was purchasing from the local wholesale McKesson wholesale distribution center. So they are one example of where that transition would be an easy one for them to make.
Thank you, Chair. Does the actual distribution to the end user have to be from brick-and-mortar pharmacy, or could it possibly set up where, if there wasn't a pharmacy that participated, some sort of mail-order process could be implemented as long as it was still within the confines of the program? Is that a possibility, or is that within some kind of rulemaking authority?
Chair Morissette, Mr. Jacobian, I think that too is how the Board of Pharmacy would set that up. It's set up now to have this be a brick-and-mortar local pharmacy. And what we didn't want to do is to take local pharmacists out of the interactions that currently occur between patients and their pharmacists. So this would be to the local, the brick-and-mortar pharmacy. They would get the medicine in the same way they get medicine right now from a U.S. wholesaler and be able to have individuals come in with a written prescription and dispense that medicine.
And one final question, perhaps, is that it would be up to the particular individual pharmacy to participate in this program.
Totally voluntary.
Okay. Good. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1026. Did you want to give an overview, please?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 1026 basically requires that insurers who cover other medical services also provide annual prostate cancer screening examinations, including digital rectal examinations and prostate-specific antigen tests. The test would be for men who are age 50 years and older, and for men younger than 50 who are at risk for prostate cancer as determined by their physicians, including African-American men with family history. This would cover all healthcare insurers and healthcare contractors who are subject to state regulation. Would establish that the act is not subject to the automatic repealer, i.e. that the act or mandate would repeal on the 6th anniversary, and would be effective upon the date of the act. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Senator Starr, welcome to our committee, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Chair Marcet, committee members, member. This bill, Senate Bill 1026, is a repeat of a bill that we had in Human Resources 2 years ago, which we passed out of committee and through the Senate. This bill has particular significance to me. It's asking that insurers cover the annual prostate cancer screening for those most likely to be affected. We know statistically that 1 in 6 men will be afflicted with this cancer. We know that early detection saves lives and saves huge amounts of cost for those individuals in which the cancer is detected early. 2 years ago, an old friend of mine came to see me and asked to have this legislation introduced. Luther Fitch is a prostate cancer survivor today. Very possibly doesn't have long to live. 8 years ago, his doctors gave him 6 months to live. But Luther is a fighter, and he has gone everywhere and tried everything, and he has been able to survive to this point because of his efforts and his determination to live. But in that process, he's learned a great deal about prostate cancer, about the tragedies of lives lost. He has formed cancer support groups in Umatilla County, over across the border in the Tri-Cities, from Hermiston to Pendleton. And he has a deep passion about preventing loss of life and undue suffering that can be prevented by early detection of prostate cancer. My own young brother is a 13-year prostate cancer survivor, but in him also that cancer has metastasized. He's shown up in its roof of his mouth. He's had the entire roof of his mouth excised. Now he's able to eat and speak plainly because he has a dental appliance that covers what is now missing in the roof of his mouth. Again, I really have a strong desire to see us pass this legislation to the Senate floor and see it passed to the Senate. I have provided to the committee the testimony of my friend Luther Fitch. Right now, doctors say there's nothing they can do for him except to try to control his pain and suffering. Cancer spread throughout his body, and he's in serious trouble. But his friend Bill Hansel, county commissioner from Umatilla County, is also one of those prostate cancer survivors who's been a part of that cancer support group that Luther's formed, and he also has provided testimony in support of this legislation. Mr. Chair, for the record, I am State Senator Charles Starr, and I'm from Senate District 13. That is my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Last legislative session, when I was the chair of the Health Policy Committee at the time, we heard testimony from a group that I think you referred to from Pendleton, Hermiston area. There were several, four or five individuals who testified, and it was very moving testimony. I think you've kind of encapsulated that. And we did pass the bill out of committee. We did pass the bill on the Senate floor. So I'm hoping we can do the same. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Irv Fletcher, would you please come up? Courtney Dresser, would you? Yes, Courtney. Irv, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Irv Fletcher, 1272 Mayanna Drive, Woodman, Oregon. I come today as a prostate cancer survivor. As of my last screening, and that's all anybody survives is on the last screening. Who knows what the next screening might turn up. As an aside, a friend of mine, prostate cancer, appeared again 18 years after his surgery. So I guess until the day somebody expires, you never know if you're free. But anyway, I know I wouldn't be here today had I not had and my health insurance, which covered prostate cancer screening. And you've already heard the bill, I think, on the colorectal screening, right?
Yes.
Well, anyway, this is late testimony, so I'll slide into I would have testified to that, too, because in 1988, colonoscopy I had determined several precancerous polyps, which were removed otherwise. That would have got me before cancer did. So I want to also testify in support of the mandatory coverage of precancer screening for both of those afflictions. Yeah, prostate cancer kills more Americans than breast cancer. Not many people know that, than breast cancer. Mm-hmm. But there isn't near the publicity or the, I think, attention given to, you know, the precancer screening for prostate cancer, too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Courtney.
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Dresser, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society here in Oregon. The American study estimates that in 2005, over 232,000 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer, and over 30,000 men will die from this disease. Since the use of early detection testing, for example, the PSA for prostate cancer, became relatively common about the 1990s, late 80s, early 90s, the prostate cancer death has dropped in this country. On the other hand, we at the American Society know that there are potential problems to the PSA, and we don't want to stand up here today without acknowledging that there are issues with the PSA test. And we do understand that, and we are, along with many other people, researching what would be the best available way to screen for prostate cancer, and if it is the PSA, making that PSA better. Until more information is available, whether men have the test is something for them and their doctor to decide. Things to consider are age and health, and also genetic history, like if you have a father with PSA or a brother with prostate cancer. These are decisions that a doctor and the man must make on their own, and if it's decided that it's best for that person to get the screening, then they should get the screening. The American Cancer Society believes that healthcare professionals should offer the PSA test and the DRE yearly beginning at age 50 to men who have at least a 10-year life expectancy. Men at high risk, such as African Americans and men who have a first-degree relative diagnosed with prostate cancer at an early age, should begin testing at 45. Men at even higher risk, because there's several relatives with prostate cancer, could begin testing at age 40. Healthcare professionals should give men the opportunity to openly discuss the benefits and risks of testing at annual checkups. Men should actively participate in this decision by learning about prostate cancer and the pros and cons of early detection and treatment of prostate cancer. The American Cancer Society, National Comprehensive Cancer Network, and others agree that recommend that healthcare professionals offer the option of testing for early detection of cancer, prostate cancer, to men once they reach a certain age. They also recommend discussing the potential benefits, side effects, and questions regarding early prostate cancer detection treatment and treatments so that men can make informed decisions about their own health. If this legislation will help make sure that when a man and a doctor discuss and decide that a PSA and DRE are appropriate for that particular person, and this will make sure that these screening exams are covered, then we at the American Cancer Society are very supportive of this legislation. Thank you.
thank you. Courtney, on the last sentence of the third paragraph in Oregon, 2,980 men will hear. Now, we're talking, is that an
annual? That's an annual.
Okay.
We do mathematical equations on population base and last year's cancer registry numbers, and that's how we determine our estimates for each year. And we do this, we have a cancer facts and figures for each year that comes out early in the year that is a nationwide, but also is based by state, too. And if I may add, I just wanted to thank Senator Starr for bringing this back, and also want to, even though he's not here at this session, thank Luther Fitch. He is a volunteer for the American Society and does our man-to-man group out in that part of the state, and we pray for him on a daily basis. When we lose volunteers like that, it's a big hole for the American Cancer Society. What we do is all based on volunteers like Luther who have passion for what they do, and we're always very supportive and very appreciative of what they do every day for us. So, okay. Thank you.
One other question. It's been said that this is more common. More men die from this type of cancer than women die from breast cancer. Do you have data on that?
I don't know if I have it right with me, but I may, because I do have some of my... our breast cancer estimates for this year are 2,100 women. So it is more common.
Okay, so the... The estimates for men then with prostate cancer would be 2,980, and for women with breast cancer is 2,110.
Oh, I'm sorry. In Oregon, it's 2,980 men, and I do not have the Oregon number for, oh, yes, I do. 2,750 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer.
No, wait a minute.
2,750.
Well, okay, 2,750, but the rest of it will, out of the men, 390 will die. Is there an estimate of the survival rate of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer?
It's over 500 women will die this year from breast cancer in Oregon.
Okay. So the death rate would be higher, but the number of incidents, I mean, death rate would be higher for women, but the number of incidents diagnosed would be higher for men. There are more men diagnosed per year.
Yeah.
With.
That would make
sense. Okay. Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Starr, I'm sorry.
I want to thank you for recognizing Luther. The Cancer Society did recognize, honor him at a meeting in Hermiston last fall, and my wife and I drove up for that and surprised him. There was over 50 people there who were either surviving spouses of cancer victims or prostate cancer survivors at that meeting. It was very touching. It really touched Luther and his wife, and was a real blessing to be able to attend that. Thank you for mentioning that.
Thank you very much. John Powell, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I appear before the committee to do two things. One, simply say that as a Regents Blue Cross policyholder, I find this benefit already paid for. I'm not aware of policies sold in Oregon. There may be some that do not pay for it.
Thank
so
you.
Hopefully, if there is a demon in the room, it's not health insurance companies. I think it is in large part due to the fact that many people fear medical testing and do not avail themselves of it.
Thank you. I was going to ask you right off the bat if my insurance... You're my insurance company.
Yeah.
I am covered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My doctor recommends I have the test, so I am covered.
Chairman, in almost all fields of testing, at least in the Regents policies, if a physician recommends a medical test, it would be covered.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to have a discussion here, Senator Starr. Are we talking about a non-existent problem here? I'm in terms of coverage. I mean, you're saying that coverage is almost universally?
Mr. Chairman, as far as I know, it is fairly universal in its application.
So if we pass this bill, will that have an impact on your clients?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of Regents, I don't think it would impact the number of tests they pay for.
Yes.
Come on up. Yeah. She represents some other health plans.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I wanted to clarify that now. Elise Brown representing America's Health Insurance Plans, and for those members here in Oregon who aren't in the room, I would just say to John's point that it is a regular practice now with all health plans. If it is ordered by the doctor, it's a regular procedure.
False. It's always been covered when I've had it done.
Okay.
In
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I just had two other points.
Yes.
One, the testimony's already been given in terms of questions surrounding the PSA test. I have the PSA test. My brother, who's currently being treated for prostate cancer, has had the PSA test. For reasons I'm not aware of, his physician allowed it to get quite high before they did the biopsies, and he is currently undergoing a series of different treatments. But the PSA test, even its founder, has written an article about the problems surrounding it. Having said that, I think it is a mistake to exempt this particular mandate, if it's going to be passed into law, from the review process. Line 16 in the printed bill removes this particular mandate from the six-year review. Medicine is like everything else. I think physicians get into practice patterns, and if the test is paid for in the law, a physician might have a liability question, even if there is some other test that comes along. They might have a question in their mind from a liability standpoint in terms of whether or not to order that test as well. So I'm simply saying that if you are going to pass this, I think it would be a mistake to exempt it from a periodic review.
Okay. Questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, excuse me.
Yeah. Yes, I
do. Senator Starr.
Since I have some technical help before me, how do you read lines 13 and 14 of the bill, or 13, 14, 15 of the bill, as related to other than insurance companies?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, insurers are organized under different statutes. One of the statutes is 750.005, which is health service contractors, which Regents is organized under as a health service contractor. And there are different requirements in terms of relationship with providers and others under those statutes. Those sections, as I understand it, were added to make sure they were included in the mandate. I did talk to legislative counsel about the way some of the mandates have come out with this language. They may, if the bill moves forward, consider moving that up into subsection 1 with where it refers to a health insurance policy. I'm not being critical of that in case they're listening. I'm simply saying that where it says an insurer offering a health insurance policy that covers hospital surgical, it could say including health service contractors defined in 750.005 and MIWAs in the other statute. I think there's another way to make that more concise and clear, that is the language defining the policies to which the mandate would apply. So I think it is just a technical Scribner issue. But I think it was put in there to assure that it applied to the whole array of insurance available to the public.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz. I'm sorry.
What's an antigen test?
A prostate-specific antigen test is the PSA. That is the PSA is the acronym for that.
That's a blood test.
It is.
Okay. And I guess, Mr. Chair, the reason for the question, because we look at science and you can just do a stick and do a cursory test. Now, a few years ago, that wasn't available. So, I guess as I was reading this, especially in reference to the sunset, which does allow us to review over time, I was just wondering if this language was maybe too specific. What's wrong with just saying annual prostate cancer screening examinations, which would include whatever is on the market at the time, wouldn't it? Rather than listing two specific ones and the third one comes along and suddenly it's not included.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, that's correct, and I'm not. I'll let the authors of the bill deal with that in terms of what their intent was, but that would be another way of doing it. I think in the last 10 years, these two tests have been the norm, and I would assume that's why they're included.
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand that, but if tomorrow they came out with something brand new that was maybe less invasive, more effective, suddenly it's not included. And not that that's necessarily going to happen, but medical marvels happen all the time, and you know, one of the reasons we've always had sunsets is so we can look at the modernization of technology ongoing over time. And I mean, it just occurred to me, Mr. Chair, that maybe just speaking to the exam covers whatever is in the medical field at the time, and this is it now, but that doesn't mean this is it 2-3 years from now. And so,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, and it might be instructive also to at this point just to give the committee the benefit of how an insurer would react to a situation where a new test came on the market like that. They very immediately form committees of physicians who have some expertise in developing the science behind the test and study all the literature. And the moment a test like that it becomes viable in terms of its diagnostic abilities and that sort of thing, they cover it. And the point I was making earlier, if that did happen, the insurers would react and they would go to the better test. And one of the reasons why I think your earlier point about not having this reviewed is the point I was trying to make is any test is going to be vulnerable to a misread either by a human or a machine, or just the test itself is probably never going to be 100% perfect. If a colonoscopy is not 100% perfect, people die of colon cancer 14 months after being declared clean of polyps because something is missed. I mean, nothing is perfect. I'm afraid if that new test became the standard and the law mandated this test, from a liability standpoint, a physician might feel obligated to order this test as well, just from a liability standpoint. That's again, in the next few months, I don't think that's going to be a problem. Over time, it could be.
Mr. Chair, and we've seen that happen with a lot of diagnostic tests that and kind of break new barriers all the time. So I mean, just a concern, understanding the intent here, that maybe a small correction might make it a little better bill.
Whatever it takes for you to carry this bill, we will do. Let the record show.
Didn't say where he's going to carry it.
True. That's okay. True.
So before we get carried away, okay. I'm going to...
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Others wishing or willing to testify.
Ms. Chair, can we get from the American Cancer Society if they think that maybe that's reasonable?
Okay.
Or
good. Thank you for this suggestion.
Just not an official anything.
In general, again, Courtney Dresser with the Cancer Society, we have to remember that when a test comes on the market, it's years before we all can agree. I mean, there's clinical trials, there's research that needs to be done, there's studies that need to be published, and then they have to be examined. And, you know, we can't... I believe there would be enough time if a new test came on the market to amend the statute if that was necessary. On the other side, thinking of Blue Cross Blue Shield and my friends, the insurers, I would be questioning, opening that up to who knows what else they could add to that, saying it is looking for prostate cancer. Now, I think they'd have to have some science based before they just were able to get reimbursed for any exam they wanted to give. So, again, I think there'd be enough time to amend the language through this legislative process if needed to. But I can't really say for or against just saying prostate cancer screening. As long as we said annual prostate cancer screening and maybe at the referral of the doctor or whatever.
Right. I guess, you know, if we're removing the sunset so it's no longer subject to review, we don't do a good job of reviewing things that are subject to review. And so once something's on book legislatively, it stays there for a long time, and to build momentum to look at it doesn't always happen in a timely fashion. So,
well, Senator Morissette and Senator Cruz, that's why we're here. The American Society wouldn't want something unstatuted here in Oregon or any state if it meant other testing wasn't being done or the appropriate test wasn't being done. So the advocates are here to make sure things are monitored and looked at, and that the correct scientific exam is happening at the right time.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing. We're going to carry this bill over. There will be an amendment to remove the sunset. We're going to do that.
Okay.
And we're going to come back with the bill. And to recap briefly, John Powell, the representing Regents, testified that this is basically covered industry-wide, basically, not necessarily every single insurance company, but it's the standard now. He raised the question of not having the sunset in and how important it is to be able to go back and review in case a new development comes along and the ability to make changes. And so we are going to carry the bill over, and there will be an amendment to it, and we will bring it back.
That was satisfying me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and Senator Cooney has volunteered to carry the bill under the circumstances.
We'll close the meeting.
Let the record show.